Welcome to the Minder Podcast.
Welcome to episode 15 of the Minder podcast in association with Minder.org. I am your host, Paul Stenning. In this show, we are back to the regular format and feature part one of an interview with Brian Croucher, who played Big John in Monday Night Fever from the very first Minder series. Far from being a bit part actor, Brian has appeared in 124 film or television productions and played a huge variety of parts. I found Brian to be a very funny, thoughtful and insightful interviewee, and he gave me a lot of time. I will point out also that I have learned that for the future, it is usually going to be best to share former episodes with the actor in question, just in case they don't remember everything about them. Considering his memory was hazy on filming Minder, Brian did an amazing job and told all sorts of great stories. We speak of the heady days of Houston films and also cover Brian's role as Chris Cottle in Out, working on the 1972 film Burke and Hare and almost playing the role of the private detective Hazel in 1978. Brian also tells of the time where he was mistaken for Billy Murray, another great veteran British actor. The interview was filmed before the passing of Dennis Waterman, which is why we speak of him in present tense. Brian tells some intimate stories and anecdotes from the early 70s through to New Tricks, and it's interesting to note how he acknowledges at the very beginning just how grateful he is to still be going when so many people are passing on. So, Houston, we have a problem. Over to Brian Croucher.
There.
Brilliant.
That's about right. Brilliant.
Very good. How are you?
I'm alive.
That doesn't sound like there's something behind that, possibly.
Well, there is. I mean, most of my contemporaries are dead now, aren't they? Bob Hoskins, Mike Elphick, Warren Clark.
Yeah.
All sorts. As you know, with your research.
Yes, Warren Clark was one I was going to mention. So you've already.
Oh, really? I was at the Royal Court with Warren.
I reckon he's. You probably were in a lot more than I sort of remembered or saw, but I thought of Oh Lucky Man.
Oh Lucky Man, yeah, I was in that. Yeah, I got stories about that. If you wanted to ask me.
So you do remember back when then? It's not when you said 1979, I'm thinking, well, a lot of the things that people into Minder really remember are from the 70s. So,
yeah. Well, it was 1980, actually, 42 yes. years ago. And I did a little bit of research for you this morning. I thought, well, there's not a lot I can tell you about Minder that you most probably don't know yourself. But the particular Minder that I did, I remember, was a smaller part than I was doing at the time. Because when I look back, I was going from job. I did four jobs in 1980. I did Minder. I originated The Gentle Touch, the first episode of The Gentle Touch, when I shot Jill Gascoigne's husband, Leslie. Ooh,
Schofield.
Pardon?
Schofield.
Yeah, Leslie Schofield. When we shot Stephen Yardley and I played brothers and we killed him and we started her story.
Yeah.
I also did Hammer House of Horror and I also did The Professionals that year. Running on from that, I was doing two or three jobs every year. after that until EastEnders, and then somehow EastEnders sort of. I think it's because EastEnders is so bad that they realised, well, I wasn't as good an actor as I made out to be. No, I mean, it's a death knell, isn't it, EastEnders? Many people have said that. You go into EastEnders and you maybe don't have a professional life afterwards.
Well, what's the reason for that, would you say?
Well, people, they say you're over whatever. What do you call it when you're over? You and you're typecast, and you're over publicized with being in a soap because you're on the screen every other day. I don't know. I moved away from London. As you can see, I live in the country now, in a little village house, and so the accessibility to London and meeting people and seeing people and going to first nights and stuff like that, I didn't do that anymore. I came and lived down here in Kent, that may have added to it. But my wife reminded me this morning, she said, your agent, Dulcie, told you it's a chance you could never work again after being in EastEnders for 2 years. But I did work, and I got older. And, you know, I say to people now, I say, we don't see you on the telly anymore. I said, well, at my age, you don't want to see a series about a retired carpenter. Yeah, so, you know, I bring out all my old, it's all tits and muscles now, and I've got tits where I'm supposed to have muscles. It's all that, you know.
That's funny, that, because Terry actually called you muscles in the episode.
Does he?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, I was a little bit more shapelier in those days.
But well, you're very tall.
Me, I'm 6'2", yeah. Mm.
So you got the presence and your profile. I remember in many different things, they always seem to have like a side profile, which really gives that someone's hit you in the face look. But right. In a, you know, that strong profile, shall we say.
Well, one thing I learned was the sort of parts that I was given, you just look somebody straight in the eyes and say, I don't like you.
It works.
It works.
Yeah, you're intimidating.
But, you know, that's the way it's got to be. So get out now or I'll throw you out. Come on, Terry. Little audition for you there.
Yeah. Did you do an audition for it, or did they just know that you could do that part?
I think I've been doing that sort of rough and ready sort of stuff for a while. I mean, I started off at the Royal Court in a play called Saved, playing Fred, who's he runs the boats on the lake. So he doesn't, oi, number four, in now, all that, you know. So he doesn't stand for any nonsense. And that's that. After that, I started my television work. So it all stems from one job leads to another. They see you. Look, it's an industry. It's like if you can make steel, you can get a good job. It's an industry. If you can look somebody in the eye and say, get out, they'll use you. You're a commodity. You're a tool. So that's how you get to play the parts that you get to play, because you're at the mercy of casting directors. And it's no problem being typecast, because Robert Redford always said, if you're being typecast, you're doing a good job. Because you're playing that character. Look at Lee Van Cleef. I mean, the way he looked, he couldn't play Vickers, could he? You know.
But, you know, as you're talking like this, I'm thinking, first of all, you're minimising some of the parts that you were given, because although you tended to play that role, you also had, say, more dialogue in something like Out with Tom Bell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was a bit more, there was a powerful program, and it was
that
quite
was
deep.
Very meaningful. I was very honoured and lucky to get that part of Chris Cottle. And it was one of a few times when you walk in and you are the person and they go, phew. I mean, Trevor Preston and Jimmy Goddard went, phew, great, you've got the part. You've got the quality that we want. You've got the strength. You've got the friendliness to, you know, Frank Ross's mate. And I got the part, you know. So it's I did a John Hopkins play at the Open Space Theatre many years ago, and I walked in and John Hopkins, who originated Zed Cars, he said, "My God," he said, "you are what I wrote." And, you know, you can't odds that. Sometimes you go in and you think, well, I did right for that part. I'll have that part. You never hear another thing. You know, it's, you know, there were lovely, there was a good work along the way, but there was a quality that, you know, you can't deny the quality that we've all got. It's our essence. And I guess things that made me who I was when I was 20, I started not to take any shit from anybody. I didn't bullshit. I wouldn't take it. A few things happened to me. You may have the knowledge that I went to prison at one point. So things started to form me in my mind, how I wanted to be and what I would accept and what I wouldn't accept. And then that then moves on to the characters that you can offer people.
After all the favours I done you, I bloody needed that job. Well, that weren't my fault. That bastard subcontractor blew out. You miserable pig. Don't piss on my shoes then tell me it's raining.
Hello, Mr. McCallum. It's Chris Cottle here. Yes, Cottle. I was wondering if you had any reaction to my estimate. Oh. Well, no, I haven't received your letter yet. Yeah, well, the post is a bit erratic lately, yes. Okay.
So how old were you when you went to prison?
I think I was about 19. I was coming to the end of an apprenticeship in the print, and the printing shop that I worked for, I was an apprentice. I remember they kindly had me back after. I only did 6 months. It was a motoring offence. They wouldn't put you away for that now because it's full up with dopers now. Prison, and it was an open prison, and it was an experience, and it started me on my way to my acting life, because I decided not to get rid of my scooter and not to hang out with the boys and do something in the evenings and not go to dance halls. So I went to evening school, and it was drama classes, because I was sort of interested in it. We were all interested in sort of drama and acting because we used to go to the cinema quite a lot in those days, because you didn't need to go up to the West End to the cinema. You could There was the Hackney Pavilion, the ABC in Wells Street. There was the Odeon up at Dalston, all those places you go. And so, you know, you used to see people as actors, Humphrey Bogart, Gary Cooper, all those people. You always used to come out of the cinema going, right, come here, you know, stand against the wall or whatever, you know, and you used to. So I went to evening school. I'm going all over the place here. I went to evening school, and from there, I went to drama school. And from there, I came out and I went to the Royal Court. And from there, I went into television and films and did other stage work. And that was my life.
So I know one of the early films you did was Burke and Hare with Glyn Edwards. I don't know whether you met him because it was a fairly small part, but it's a weird film.
I think the Burke and Hare thing I got through a childhood friend of mine who was a second assistant director, and I had to throw cream pies at a bare-breasted prostitute dressed as a grenadier. I think that's what I did. I don't know if you've never seen it. So.
I have seen it, but a long time ago. I can't remember that. It's a weird film, so I can believe it.
I mean,
you get
to do some great things. And you going back to Out, one of the great moments, there were many in Out, was when Norman Eshley came as the bailiff, and I was a bit drunk. Do you remember Out at all?
I do remember.
And he comes in, and I say, "Oh, you want? What do you want? Yeah, you want to take this? You want to take that? I suppose you want this typewriter, do you? You want this kind? Want this typewriter? Well, go and get it." And they got a sugar glass window, and bosh.
Ah, Mr. Turnip. 3 o'clock on the bat. I bet he was a Brussels sprout.
Is the car back? And the money?
£15, 38p. And a snotty wipe.
Oh, dear. I thought we were going to be sensible.
I say what, Brussel. I'll give your client a cut. And if he presents it, say, within 2 weeks...
Well, no, that won't do at all. I'll tell you what. That timber in your yard, it must be worth, what, 3,000?
That's for a job.
I'll send someone around to collect it. We will, of course, reimburse you for anything we make above what you owe us. Minus, of course, a small consideration for... inconvenience?
For a moment there, Brussel, I thought you were being serious.
No, I never joke where money is concerned.
You polish, yeah. Oh!
You're out of condition, Mr. Cotton.
You bastard!
There you go. There's your typewriter. Jimmy Goddard said, "Look, that was brilliant, Brian, but we screwed up on the camera. We have to do it again." I went, "Oh, no, not throw a typewriter through a window again." I think we did it 3 times, but that was great. And I said to somebody, "I'll never get to do anything like this ever again in my life." You know, throwing cream cakes at tarts and typewriters through windows. Such is the life of an actor. You can't dream it up, can you?
I'll take it you were enjoying this type of freedom when you were, because you would have been in your 30s when you were doing Out, sort of mid-30s.
Yeah. I'd learned a lot because, you know, I came to the business of acting from nowhere. My mother did say that we have got a show business connection. One of my cousins was a ventriloquist. Well, that is really funny, that is, for an actor. But I came out of nowhere and I got to learn my trade. You know, I went to Lambda where I met all sorts of people, people who came from Oxford and wanted to be an actor, and people with double-barreled names. I mean, I came out of Hackney in the East End. I was a grammar school boy, so I wasn't stupid. But, you know, by the time I got out, I sort of knew what I was doing and what I could offer and how I would approach it all. Although one day it did scare me a little. Jimmy Goddard, we were at Tulse Hill. There was a scene where Frank and Chris, it's when he comes out of prison and he comes back to his old house, and Chris meets him there, gets out of the car, blah, blah, blah. But they were going to shoot an outside scene. That's where they were basing their work that day, in the morning. We weren't scheduled to actually do the scene. It's quite a long scene where you go in the house and then there's a big scene in the living room. And so it rained. And of course, rain cover was the interior of the, and it was quite a long scene. And Jimmy said, "Do you know this scene? We're going to do it tomorrow." But I said, "I think I do." And so I had to gen it up very quickly, and we shot the scene. And in that scene, I had to smoke a cigarette, and for continuity, they had to keep coming and cutting the cigarette to certain points. For you couldn't just have a new cigarette, you know. And at the end of the scene, Tom said to me, "You know, one thing you'll learn from this scene: never smoke unless you really have to." he was a lifelong friend, Tom. Not a lot of people got Tom, but I got Tom, and I just used to laugh at him. You know, when he used to get a bit, as it were, northern saucy, I just used to laugh at him because, "Oh, yeah, you want me to buy you a drink, do you? Eh? Eh? Hmm?" All that went on. I remember I went to his house in Brighton once, knocked on the door. I was appearing at the Theatre Royal, and I found out where he lived, knocked on the door. I went, "Hello, Tom." He went, "Oh, right, you're coming for a drink. You want a drink? Come on, come on. Get in. Yeah." So we got in, I sat down. I suppose you want something to eat as well, do you? Huh? Huh? And I went, "Yeah, well, it would be nice." Yeah. He went, "There you go." And he threw me a cold lamb chop across the room. That was Tom. He was a fan. He phoned me and said, "Look, I'll be outside your place within the hour." He said, we'll go out and have a drink. So I had to explain to my wife then. I said, "Tom's going around. He wants to go and have a drink." "Oh, right. Okay." So I said, he's got a chauffeur-driven car. And we drove. And I think we went and had a drink with Brian Cox, who was an old friend of mine from Lambda. But we were away for two or three days. This guy driving us around from pub to pub.
So was Tom Bell quite intense? You're making him sound a bit more comical in some ways. Was that just how you perceived him?
Well, he was comical to me, but he took no prisoners as an actor. You know, you had to be up there with him. And because he doesn't make any, didn't, and he became the character. He was, and you know, an ultimate actor. He became the character, and he did it. And he'd do it to your detriment if you didn't play along with him within the scene. You know.
So we're doing something like that with an actor like him. Do you think that helped you and made you better? And you,
oh, I enjoyed it. Look, you know, I always say I've taught in the past acting, and I've always said, you know, one of the ideas about acting is, you know, if you're playing Hitler, you've got to kill as many Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, etc., etc., and then you will become Hitler. You can't just say, oh, we'll kill 10 Jews today and we'll leave the gypsies out of it. You can't do that. And so you have to commit yourself to what you're doing, and you have to be prepared. I mean, when I used to teach, they used to mess about in the corner when we would. I said, listen. And they're, what? What's that, Brian? I said, listen, you're talking about where you were last night and what you did and how many drinks you had and blah, blah, blah. I said, you don't do that. You're playing Astroff in The Three Sisters or something. Where did he come from? Where's he going? Et cetera, et cetera. Get your head in gear and don't talk to him about the car that you're going to buy. It's preparation and commitment, and that's what Tom did.
So if you were doing that before the scene starts or whatever, does that mean that you try and stay away from people who you're supposed to be violent towards or unfriendly towards?
Offset? No, not necessarily. I mean, it's got a bad name. It's called The Method. The Americans just called it The Method. Stanislavski called it something, you know, An Actor Prepares. There's a book called An Actor Prepares, or My Life in Art was something else, but An Actor Prepares. And it's something that gives you the character. Sometimes it's an overcoat, sometimes it's the shoes, sometimes, and that's the outer side. But the inner side is what you're going to do. You're going to murder this person, or you're going to tell your wife you want a divorce, or whatever dramatic device that you're involved with in that particular project. You have to. There's some times where you can be lighthearted and then go and do the scene, but you've got to know what you're doing. I mean, it's no good. You've got bricks, you've got cement, and you've got a trowel. Well, you've got to know how to mix the cement and sand and where to put it and how to tap the bricks and how to, you know, a bricklayer is the same as an actor. You have to, and sometimes there's a bit of discussion how you're going to approach it, but most times it's like a footballer, you know, say, well, I scored a hat trick and I think I might score one today. Now, don't say, I think you go on the field, score the hat trick, and then we'll talk about it. Mm. Can't talk about. You have to discuss a little bit, but then you have to go and show in a little rehearsal what you might do. Because in films, you actually direct, you prepare and direct yourself at home, and you come to it and you play out the scene. It's a negotiation between you and the other actor and the director.
So the episode of Minder that you're in was Mike Vardy was the director. Did he direct you as such in that, or was it fairly straightforward what you had to do?
Paul, it was very difficult to remember. It's one of the jobs that I don't remember very well. I remember it was in Villiers Street. I think it was outside a club called Heaven. Was it?
Yeah.
That's a gay club. It was. And they used, I was on the outside, and Keith, there's a shot on Google of me. And I think I was in a t-shirt. But I can't remember a lot more about it. It's terrible. So I said to you when you first approached me, Big John, small part. Because it was a smallish part compared to some of the stuff I was doing or had been doing around that time.
Full Bacardi and Coke. Excuse me. I had a full drink there. They've taken it away.
We're closed. It's not an all-night bloody drinking club.
Full drink? I haven't even touched it.
Shut up and get out.
Listen, I had a full drink on that table.
You trying to make trouble?
I'm going to complain about you. Take your hands off me. Take your hands off me.
You was a great help.
Yeah, well, they weren't exactly the wild bunch, were they? Now, who do I see about getting paid?
Me.
Well? No, should be three of those.
Tenner.
And another fiver for VAT.
Now look here, pal.
Now don't give me any look here, pal business. A mate of mine phoned me up, asked me to stand in for him, right? He said three fivers. That's what I'm leaving here with. How terribly kind.
The next time your mate can't make it, I'll find a debt.
With the money you're paying, you'll probably get Muhammad Ali, won't you?
Do you remember, for instance, Dennis and George meeting them? And obviously you had to actually, you were in scenes with both of them. So,
was I?
Yeah.
I mean, I should have really tried to find, see if I could find the episode. Is it available anywhere, Minder?
Yeah, it should be. That episode is on YouTube, usually.
Oh, okay. So. Yeah, I can't remember doing much with George, but I mean, I sort of knew Dennis, although I was never in the Sweeney. People always said, well, I saw you in the Sweeney. No, they saw me in programmes like the Sweeney, but I never got to I mean, in fact, one of the stories, when I was younger, Billy Murray and I had looked a little bit familiar, and I was going through customs at Heathrow Airport one day, and it was he played a bent copper in the Sweeney, and this lady on the duty free, she said I saw you in a week and in the Sweeney, bloody mother, can you, I said, it wasn't me. She went, no, don't start. I said, no, it wasn't me. I said, I'm not Billy Murray. She said, you are, I saw you. You were driving the police car, blah, blah, blah. So in the end, to get my flight, I had to say best wishes, Billy Murray, and left.
He was in The Bill, and he was in an episode of Minder as well later. But
I think so. Yeah, but Billy was in lots and lots. Rock. He started big part in Rock Follies, I believe, years ago.
Did Mike Vardy direct you when you were in The Bill?
Do you know, I don't know. I don't think he did. But I remember I did another job with him. I mean, I could research that, but it's a bit late now. I think this was the second job I did with him. I arrived a bit late one day, and he was a bit upset with me, but... That was about it. But he wasn't an enormous part to remember. Although I don't know why I can't remember it. I mean, I made some notes. I did Minder, and I did The Gentle Touch, as I mentioned before, with Stephen Yardley and Leslie Schofield. I mean, Gascoigne, Jill Gascoigne, I did a play with her in the West End. After that, she was a good lady. She was another total professional lady. She was an ex-dancer who became an actress. And then I did... when I did The Gentle Touch, there was a director called Tony Warmby. He did a lot for LWT and was head of drama. And we were talking one day, and he said, well done, Brian, blah, blah, blah. And we got talking. He said, do you know what? He said, I'd never told you this before, but we had bought the rights to the series that Nicholas Ball did called Hazel. And we had the rights, and we had them, and we were going to do it. And then we were put back, and we were going to do it. And he said, and you were going to play Hazel for me. And it just shows you can be in one direction and then you can think, but no, you don't go in that direction, you go in another direction. So, I, you know, I thought, oh God, yeah. There's things like that where, I mean, I think I was in it from Pennies from Heaven years after that. I was in the last three for Pennies for Heaven with Michael Elphick and Bob Hoskins, where you nearly get the part. Or, well, Tony said, well, the thing was that it expired the hold that they had on Hazel, and it went to Thames, and then Nicholas Ball got the part. And then sometime after that, or after that, Gentle Touch, I did Hammer House of Horror with Nicholas Ball, and it called The House That Bled to Death. And we couldn't stop laughing one day because it was all about horror and about blood, and this cat had been killed, so they got this stuffed cat. And it was on the windowsill. I laughed now, and I couldn't look at Nick, and he could look at me, because every time we saw this stuffed cat, we couldn't do the scene. We cracked up. It was very funny. And then the other thing I did after that in the 80s was The Professionals, and with Martin Shaw, who I shared a flat with when we were at Lambda together. He was in the year above me at Lambda. So that was sort of, that wrapped up 1980s. But I looked through, and there were so many others. Yeah, I mean, you must have a list and questions you might want to ask me about stuff.
Well, just before, I was you mentioned LWT and Thames, and I just obviously, with it being Newstone Films that you were, I think they did Out, and obviously Minder. So from the inside perspective, how do you remember Euston Films? Was it this kind of magical little company, or were they the same as other TV companies?
I think they... Well, if you talk about the Sweeney, Minder and Out... well, not the upper hand, because that wasn't drama. Well, it was, because on a black woman was there. I think she kept... Anyway, that's something else. Anyway, you know, all those tough, gritty, London-esque, I suppose. That's what they did. And... Each company, it's like typecasting, I suppose. They get to be known. And Trevor was writing, he wrote a snooker. Was that a series? And Jimmy Goddard directed a lot of stuff there. You know, the grouping and the subject matter starts to be the style of house, I suppose. It was, I guess it was the place to be, really.
Well, the thing is, I've got this good girl singer.
Maybe you should let me decide that.
What?
Whether she's very good. Got a demo?
Got a what?
Cassette.
Now, look, just take my word for it, eh? Did you get that toy for Christmas?
Friend of mine got the number 5 in the charts.
We get a lot of presents.
Only way to do business, isn't it? Presents given, favours done. Everybody's happy.
You want the record companies here. You want the booking managers, television people. Takes a lot of arranging. Phone calls, drinks, the musical press.
Yeah, all that.
Backing, top musicians. I mean, that'll set you back 300 for a start. My time, my staff's time, all the arrangements, the hassles, my reputation. Maybe joint management of Ilaika.
What does it all add up to?
Simple figures. 6. Readies.
Well...
No. No arguments, no haggling. 600 up front. That's it. Good chick singer. I mean, you could end up making a fortune.
Well, man of my experience, why would I be interested otherwise?
with, and that's the sort of stuff they did. I mean, I watched a couple of Sweeney's the other day, and I thought, this is not as good as we thought it was. It was sort of a bit slightly unreal. It's like middle-class actors or actors trying to be real. And some can do it and some can't. I hope that I could do it, because I always complained about, you know, Vicar's sons playing gangsters. And also the way it was shot in those days, they didn't have the camera work and, you know, these days when I don't know how they do these. I mean, talking of something completely different, yesterday I took my grandchildren to see Sonic the Hedgehog 2, and how they actually get all this to work with puppets and what's his name, who plays, he's a Gurner. He pulls all those faces. Anyway, the American actor. God.
Jim Carrey, is it?
Yeah, Jim Carrey's in it. How they get it all and all the explosions and that, I mean, how they get that to work is unbelievable. That's how it's moved on in 40 years, TV and film. But it's compared to now, it seems a little bit amateur.
Mm.
You know, I mean, without, you know, saying that it was no good, it was at the time, it's historical, in historical context compared to now, it was a little bit, you know. You know what I mean, Paul?
I do, yeah.
There's a big hole I might banish down
there. Yes. Well, let's take it more modern with when you're in new tricks. How do you rate that as the crossover to a more similar-ish but more modern, bit slicker? And
well, I'm glad that they were giving work to older actors, because when you get to 50 or 60, it starts to wane, and so they gave Alan, although I've always said Alan Armstrong, his Cockney characters that he played were always a bit wrong. It was like Sam Kidd and Percy Herbert from the, from the films in the 50s. What's his name? Who else was in New Tricks?
James Bowen.
James Bolan, Alan, and who was Dennis. The third one?
Pardon? Dennis Waterman.
And Dennis, yeah. No, it's nice to see Dennis. I used to play football with him with the showbiz, and he used to think he was a very good footballer. He got his team together, and he was always centre forward. They never scored a goal, bless him. I mean, you don't see this, Dennis. and he was still smoking. I couldn't believe it. Everybody else had stopped smoking, but Dennis was still smoking.
Is he still a big drinker as well? Because he seems to be able...
Yeah, he does like a glass of vodka, I believe, yeah.
Mm.
And that's happened to a few, but dear old Michael Elphick, that's what killed him. I remember I did a voiceover with him once, and he said, come on, let's go and have a drink. So we were in Soho, and he said, two large vodka and orange, please. I went, oh, no, he said, no, try that. Yeah, so then I bought one, and he went down, and he went, two large. I said, I've got to go, Michael. I can't drink at this pace. But he ended very sadly. There were stories about him in Soho. But and he was a great actor. He came out of nowhere, and he was real, you know.
I was just going to say that it's one of the questions I had for you, really. You know, what element of yourself is, because you seem to have this persona of there's a nice guy in there and there's a friendly guy and then there's the guy you don't want to cross. But sometimes you're one much more than the other. Michael Elphick was quite similar. There's like a likability and you want to like this person, but you're also a bit scared by them.
A bit wary.
Yeah.
Well, I was going back to certain things, my life in the East End and you can get crossed by people anywhere in life. You know, you can live in Stoke Poges and somebody can break into your house and burglarize you. Or you can live with a dodgy neighbor. But I remember things in the East End that I wouldn't stand for. You know, you have an experience and you go, I wouldn't stand for that. I mean, I had to sort a neighbour out for my father once. And my parents, they bought some hookie gear, knocked off gear once, and the police came and found it. I think it was a fridge or something, and they just confiscated it. And I thought, and this bloke knowingly, hairdresser around the corner, used to sell this hookie gear. You know, and I thought, I'm not going to stand for that. I'm not going to stand for people doing the... So you become quite strong and and you start to decide, a bit like acting, really. Acting's about choices and decisions. You can play it this way or you can play it that way. But on the day, when you're with the director and the other actor, you have to decide that's the way you're going to play it. And that's why some performances, that they haven't thought it through and play it a certain way, because it has to be, acting is a positive experience. Even though you're playing a weak person, you have to positively play that weakness, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was growing up in the East End of London that gave me the tougher side. I think I wasn't a country boy. Many things happened in the East End in the 50s and 60s when I was growing up. And then of course I got to the King's Road in the 60s, and it was all sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We had a great time.
Mm.
No, you're quite right, my dear. Dress look nicer.
Sorry, Sharon, I wasn't very much together.
You and your band, you ought to be nicked.
That wasn't our fault.
Well, whose fault was it then?
Well, she just did a few bum notes, that's all.
Bum notes? You weren't exactly Mantovani yourself.
Who?
Oh, he says. Mantovani. Famous musician, bloody great orchestra, could play anything.
Oh, well, they're difficult numbers for a band like ours.
Listen, for 300 quid a go, you should be able to get through the Warsaw Concerto.
300?
Your poxy fee.
We got 25 quid, and that's a five more than last time.
What did you say?
25?
Dry her tears. You turn me over.
Now, calm down, Mr. Daly.
Calm down? You had 600 quid off me.
She went off. She went off. Not my fault.
Where are the people? The record producers and celebs.
Didn't show. Invites, telephone calls. Did I try my best, John?
Worked our fingers to the bone, didn't we?
You're lying. I want my dough back.
Then all I can suggest is that you put the matter in the hands of your legal advisers.
I don't have legal advisers, Sonny. I have people who come round and punch your little head in.
That's a very nasty threat, Mr. Daly.
Made in front of witnesses. Perhaps you'd better show Mr. Daly the door, John.
Hey, watch it. That's an 80 guinea velvet.
And we don't want it messed up now, do we, Mr. Daly?
You don't know me, son, do you?
Well, we have heard the name. What was that old election slogan? Yesterday's people. That's a trouble, ain't it, Mr. Daly? Times change, don't they? See ya.
You always seem very calm when you're, even when you're in a fairly violent scene or intimidating scene, you're always calm. Is that something you had to, is that just you, or did you have to work on that?
I think violence comes, you know, if you're going to enter a violent situation, you don't know if you're going to pull a knife on me or not. And if you do pull a knife, I mean, of course, there are scenes where you just go and poke someone and say, listen, you don't leave my daughter out of it. Go, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's other scenes where you're negotiating not to have this violence. I don't think people go for violence. So you start from back there and then it gets to a point where you have to take some action, whether it be verbally or with whatever, you know. I've never noted that you've, I start from a place of calmness. But I think all acting is from a place of calmness because, you know, I finish my little spiel now and I go back to calmness and I wait for your next question. You see what I mean?
Yeah, but it's still, it's really noticeably different to others. I mean, let's take, say, Dennis Waterman in mind. He'd quick to lose his temper. So he'd have a bit of a, you know, a narc at someone or something, and then he'd be all right again. So I think, based on what I've heard, maybe Dennis Waterman has a temper in real life. And so that makes sense that he loses temper quite often. So, you know, there's more intimidation to the calm threat of violence or imposition from someone than lots of verbals. Yeah.
But maybe I always used to, and still do if I'm asked, life is about this interview, this meeting that we're having is about thinking. You're thinking your side from the information I'm giving you for maybe another question that you may not have thought about when, you know, in your preparation. So acting is about thinking more than before you say yes or no. You might say, there's a million ways to say no, or no, or no. You know, there's a million ways. So you've got to think. I mean, when I was teaching a class once, as we were doing some scenes from Chekhov's The Three Sisters, and Solione. There's a character called Solione who's very peripheral. And he makes chicken sounds. It's like a comment, you know, but he doesn't get involved. But other times he's just there standing around and being part of the scene. And the guy who was playing the character came up to me one day. He said, Brian, I'm not sure what I'm doing. He said, because I'm standing at the back. And I'm not doing it. I'm not involved. And I said, but, you know, where does the chicken sounds come from? And, you know, does he, when he's not saying anything, does he switch off? I said, no, he's thinking all the time. We are all thinking all the time, but we don't, sometimes we think a lot and then just say, I'm going out. You know, but you have to have the thought before the action. You can't have the action before the thought. And sometimes, maybe with Dennis, the action came with little, very little thought. I don't know, but that's my take on it.
I don't know if you remember this, but you just reminded me with the guy stood in the back. You were in a film called The Deadly Game in 1982.
Oh, yeah.
And you that played a mute.
Yeah, well, that was great. I mean, that was actually funny. George Segal, he tried to get me at it a number of times, but I didn't crack. I didn't crack at all. I go, "Hi, Pierre. How you doing today, Pierre? You know, blah, 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 blah. Oh, Pierre, you're not talking again." It was, and he's gone now. I can say he was in time of cocaine. He used to go to the bathroom and come back. Yeah. The producer one day, we were rehearsing at the BBC. One of the assistant producers, he opened up, he went, "Hey, do you want to, I said, this is the BBC, we're working, we don't take cocaine, in rehearsal room 6, please." and then, of course, I had to wake Robert, I used to call him Bobo, Robert Morley, and he'd fall asleep. And they say, "Oh, can we do the scene now?" So, "Oh, come on, you're on." Oh. and then another thing, Ellie and Eli Landau, who were HBO producers, a Jewish couple, big, rather larger than life Jewish American couple, they were the producers. And they came in to see us all once. So there was Trevor Howard, dear Trevor. He couldn't remember his lines. He had to have an earpiece in the end. I'm telling you things I shouldn't, but they're gone now. So, but there was Trevor Howard, Green, Alan Webb, who played the hangman. And we were all in a rehearsal room. They used to bring us food because the guys didn't want to leave the rehearsal room because they were old. They were in their dotage. They came in, the Ellie and Eli, and they said, "Oh, hi, everybody. How are things going?" Yeah, you like. And it was lunchtime. And they said, "I hear good things about it." And how's the lunch? And Robert Morley went, "Oh, yes. Marvellous, marvellous. Especially as it's free."
Oh, you can see it.
Even with all his money, he liked a free meal.
Did you meet Connie Booth in that? I presume you did. I know she wasn't in it for long, but
yeah, there was Connie Booth, Leslie. She was in
Dunlop.
Dunlop for she was in yeah for a while. Yeah, I did, but I can't remember anything other than just going up there and doing the work. We all had the smaller parts, of course. It was all George Segal and Trevor Howard and Alan Webb. And who was the other guy who played the prosecuting? No, Trevor Howard plays the prosecutor. The defender, Green, was it? No, it wasn't. Graham Green? No, it wasn't Graham Green. Who wrote? Cornish Green. Was that? But no, I can't remember.
I can't. I've only seen remember. It. I did see it fairly recently, actually. But
did you?
Yeah.
How did it hold up?
I thought it was excellent. It was very sinister, and it was a play that just as soon as they sort of zoomed in, you thought it was a film. You completely forgot that it was just on a stage, and so I thought.
Ah, I see. Yeah, but it was based on a Durham Mat novella. It's that they took it from that and then adapted it to I know if the guy was American, the guy who in the avalanche or the snowstorm found himself in this village in the Alps, maybe, I don't know. But yeah, it was that was great. I mean, another one of the meeting the greats, Rob Morley, Trevor Howard. I've met so many, like David Niven, Ernest Borgnine, worked with all these people, and they're just guys like you and me, you know.
I hope you enjoyed the very funny and direct Mr. Croucher. I certainly did. Come back in a few weeks for part two with Brian. In the meantime, all Minder podcast shows have been archived, if there are any you have missed so far. Thank you to everyone who has written in about the passing of Dennis and your compliments on recent shows. It is much appreciated. We've had the biggest response so far to the Andrew Payne interviews, so it's nice to know that these are acknowledged as enjoyable and revealing. They certainly felt that way to me when Andrew was talking, as if stories which had never been told were finally able to come out. So if you've not already heard those interviews and you're a fan of the programme, those interviews will give you a real insight into how the show developed. Why not also check out the Minder fan site, minder.org, truly an incredible record of all things Minder. That's minder.org. If you want to write to this show, the email is winchesterclub@minderpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.